When the infinite inning has you in its unshakable grasp, it's important to remain phlegmatic. You can hear the air quotes in my voice. I say it that way, phlegmatic, because it's not a word that we use very often. It's a great word, but it's not in general circulation, probably because not too many people are phlegmatic. The dictionary definition of phlegmatic is a person having an unemotional and stolidly calm disposition. In other words, the stress rolls off of them like water off of a duck's back. The 1936 World Series was an all-New York affair, with the Yankees taking on the then New York Giants. The Yankees had last been in a World Series in 1932. After that, they needed a few seasons to deal with Babe Ruth's decline and get reorganized into the team of Joe DiMaggio. So there were a few years without them, years where the pennants went to the Senators and Tigers. But in 36, DiMaggio's rookie year, it all clicked, and they won the race going away with 102 wins. They finished almost 20 games ahead of the second-place Tigers. DiMaggio was great, but the team's big hitter, and also the league MVP, was first baseman Lou Gehrig. He hit .354 with 49 home runs. He scored 167 times, which is still the second highest total of the modern era. The big pitchers were Red Ruffing and Monty Pearson. Ruffing is in the Hall of Fame, so I figure you've heard of him, but Pearson was one of those starters, and these are the vast majority of starting pitchers, if you think about it, who can only muster a few good years before their arms fall off, and no one remembers them, but they might have had a few 18 or even 20-win seasons in there somewhere, low ERA seasons where, had there been a Cy Young Award back then, they probably would have received a bunch of votes. The Giants were working under player-manager Bill Terry, who'd been there since John McGraw retired mid-season 1932, and they'd actually been more successful in the short term in that they had more recently won the World Series, beating the aforementioned Washington Senators in 1933. They didn't have the greatest offense. Their best hitter was Mel Ott, who hit .328 with 33 home runs that year, which doesn't sound like much by our rabbit ball standards, but it was actually pretty huge. But they had a great pitcher, a Hall of Fame pitcher, with the screwballer Carl Hubbell, who was kind of the Clayton Kershaw of his day. I don't know if he had the velocity of a Kershaw, but he was just as hard to score off of. Anyway, aside from Ott, the rest of the lineup was just okay. There was center fielder Hank Lieber, who was kind of an A.J. Pollock player, but you've never heard of him because he had only one healthy season in his whole career, and then World War II service finished him at 31. But not in the usual way that World War II service interrupted players' careers. He had a chicken ranch, and after the 1942 season, he found he could make more money selling poultry and eggs to the army, so he just quit. Game one was played in rainy conditions at the Polo Grounds. It doesn't sound like anybody had very much fun. Hubbell got the best of Ruffing, allowing a solo home run to Yankees right fielder George Selkirk in the third, but he otherwise shut the visitors out, striking out eight in a complete game win. That was a lot of strikeouts back then. Ruffing went all the way too, and you can see how thinking about relief pitching affected things back then. Yankees manager Joe McCarthy actually did more work with his bullpen than most managers of the day, but in this case he stuck with Ruffing, and although Red kept them in the game through seven, he gave up four runs in the bottom of that inning, helped by an E6 and an intentional walk. The game went from 2-1 Giants to 6-1 Giants, and that was the final score. Lou Gehrig had gone 0-for-3 with a strikeout and reached once when Hubbell hit him. He was asked for a comment after the game. "Tomorrow," he said, "is another day." Well, all right, not the deepest thought, but fine. So tomorrow was actually another 2 days away because Game 2 was rained out. But when they resumed the series at the Polo Grounds, the result was very different. The Yankees scored 18 runs, still one of the highest totals ever in a postseason game. Pounding a normally very reliable right-hander, Hal Schumacher, who's one of those guys I was talking about when I was talking about Pearson before, had some really good seasons, but not anything that added up to a career that we want to put in Cooperstown. The Yankees starter was Lefty Gomez, and he pitched badly, but he went all the way and allowed only four runs, so he got the win, even though he walked seven and struck out eight. It's a fair guess he threw over 150 pitches that day. The biggest hit of the game was second baseman Tony Lazzari's third-inning grand slam. Lou Gehrig went 2-for-5 with a walk, drove in three runs, scored one. And after this game, in which the Yankees had evened up the series, scoring 18 runs, Lou was asked for a comment. "Tomorrow," he said, "is another day." Yes, the exact same thing that he had said after Game 1. Lou Gehrig may in fact have been phlegmatic. Or he was totally empty. I don't know which it was. Either nothing bothered him because he had the grace to not let it bother him, or nothing bothered him because he lacked the awareness to let it bother him. And I don't know which it was. I do know that prior to getting married in September 1933, this was a man who would spend his time off going to Coney Island and riding the roller coasters by himself. And that bit of evidence seems to support either hypothesis. The Yankees won the World Series in six. It was the first of four in a row that they would win. And for those of you who aren't Yankees fans out there, I don't think you will shed any bitter tears over the fact that they really should have won 6 in a row, but Joe McCarthy screwed up the 1940 season pretty badly. And I don't know if anyone asked Lou Gehrig for a comment after the final game, but if they did, I really hope that he said, "Tomorrow is another day." It's not a bad philosophy. It put me in mind of this classic old song from 1936, music by Jerome Kern, that debuted in the Fred Astaire Ginger Rogers movie, Swing Time. Here's a cover version recorded by Nat King Cole.
Pick yourself up. Take a deep breath. Dust yourself off and start all over again. Nothing's impossible, I have found. For when my chin is on the ground, I pick myself up, dust myself off, and start all over.
The song, like Gehrig's attitude, begs the question, what is the proper response to getting knocked on your butt? Sometimes a loss isn't a test of your ability to regroup, but a test of your ability to cut your losses. It's kind of like shell shock. Losing your mind when a people over the next ridge are trying to murder you isn't irrational, but super rational.
Work like a soul inspired, till the battle of the day is won. You may be sick and tired, but you'll be a man, my son. Will you remember the famous men who had to fall to rise again? So take a deep breath.
I guess I have a confession to make. I love the song. I love the work of Kern and Fields. I love Astaire and Rogers, but that song kind of brings me down sometimes. Because here's the reality, I'm not phlegmatic. And like Gehrig said, tomorrow is another day. But when you're in the infinite inning, that's not the solution, that's the problem. I'm Stephen Goldman, and this is the Infinite Inning Baseball Podcast. It's that day we all celebrate, the anniversary of your natal day, and the wife has hinted that a surprise is in the offing. When you return home from work that day, there are many cars parked in front of your house, and you realize this is what she meant, a surprise party, vowing to play along and enter a state of darkness so complete that you feel as if you've been swaddled from head to toe in pure midnight. There's a click, lights come on, and a shouted, "Surprise!" But when your eyes adjust, you expect to see friends, family, loved ones, and indeed, they're all present. But for the first time, you perceive them as they really are. They're all werewolves. And as they set to tear you limb from limb, you cry plaintively, "But it's my birthday." "No, it isn't," says your wife, fangs gleaming. "It's episode 25. It's your party, and you can cry if you want to. At least until they eat your tongue." Well, welcome back to the show. Very pleased to be talking to you again, and I'm not just saying that. As always, I improvise those little vignettes that I begin with, and as I was doing that one, I don't really know where it came from, but I was thinking, why are you doing this now, mid-October? You should be saving it for the Halloween episode. Except I'm not really into that stuff. You know, I was always uncomfortable going around in costume, and I stopped trick-or-treating way earlier than most of my peers. I'm very shy, and I just felt uncomfortable going around to strangers' doors and knocking on them, and my parents had gone in completely for the urban legends about poisoned candy and all that, and so they wouldn't really let me eat what I'd gotten anyway. So the whole thing, it wasn't fun, it was stressful and frightening, because if you really believed what they did, that these strangers were booby-trapping the stuff they handed you when you came to the door, then why did you want to go see them in the first place? I'm putting on this uncomfortable, flammable costume that I can't see out of and I can't breathe in, and I feel like an idiot even at 5 or 6 or however old I am. Like, my dignity is completely gone, and I'm going to knock on the doors of people who my own parents believe are trying to kill me. So no, I'm not into the whole Halloween theme thing. But having talked about it now, I can see where the germ of the idea that everybody you know is secretly a monster might have come from. My parents did as good a job as they were capable of doing, and if that sounds like faint praise, I don't mean it that way. It's all anyone can do, really. And yet, it's still amazing how, when you get under the hood of your own psyche, there are all these traps that your folks laid years ago without even intending to. And now that I'm a parent myself, I can see how everything you do has unintended consequences for your kid and sets a precedent that may linger in their psyche for decades. It's an awesome responsibility. In a moment, I'll be joined by Jazzy Jesse Spector, who was kind enough to step in when the schedule had to be rearranged a bit. Not the first time that he's done that, and it's always fun to talk with him. And since we're in the midst of the playoffs, as I told you last week, we can't cover it minute by minute as a daily show would do, but we hit some of the big topics that came up in the first week, such as Joe Girardi's epical non-instant replay call. And if you read my piece on FanRag on the redemption narrative and how presumptuous I think it is, you have a hint as to where that discussion might go. Fair warning, towards the end, we also briefly discuss the vice president's visit to Indianapolis for the ostensible purpose of attending the Colts game last weekend. I do have to make one apology in that, you know how in some of the other episodes I've said, well, there was some interference in recording the guest. I don't really know what's up with that. I do the same thing every time. Well, this time it wasn't the guest. Jesse was great. But for whatever reason, my mic came in red hot. And I wasn't aware of this at the time, but when I played back the show, my dialogue fuzzes just a little bit because the mic was overamped. That's not a button I pushed. It's not a thing that I did. And in checking back over all our settings and connections and everything else, there's no real explanation for it. And I'll be spending the week between when you hear this and when the next episode goes up trying to figure out just what the heck happened. I hope it doesn't bother you. If it wasn't listenable, I would have bagged the whole thing or re-recorded my lines somehow. Although, again, this is a spontaneous and unrehearsed program, and it's not like I can just read a script and repeat everything. So bear with me, and next time will be better. I don't think it's that bad. I will not subject you to anything that's not worth your time. Because of some executive-level tweeting on Puerto Rico this morning, I'm tempted to toss aside my notes and talk a bit about Roberto Clemente, the Pirates great who was born there. Possibly that's predictable, but it's relevant because we have the executive branch talking about practically abandoning the place to its fate after hurricane season wrought so much destruction on it. And that intention stands in extreme contrast to the actions of Clemente himself. As I think you know, he was a right fielder. He was the epitome of defense at the position during his career with an incredible arm. He hit .317, he won 4 batting titles, and he made exactly 3,000 hits. And the reason he had exactly 3,000 is that he got the final hit at the end of the 1972 season, and then that December, a massive earthquake hit Managua, Nicaragua. And it's not an exaggeration to say that the city was just flattened. It's hard to know how many people were killed, but 5 figures seems likely, and hundreds of thousands were displaced, that much is certain. Clemente organized relief aid, got on a rickety plane to deliver a batch of needed goods himself, and the plane crashed, and that was the end of Roberto Clemente. But why did he go? He wasn't Nicaraguan. If Dennis Martinez wants to organize relief for Nicaragua, you get it, but Clemente had no more connection to Nicaragua than he did to Luxembourg. And the answer is, he went because he was a mensch, because people were suffering and he had the means to help. That's it. You do it because it's the right thing to do. That's what Roberto Clemente teaches us. It's useless to talk about it, though, because if those in charge don't have empathy now, they're not going to get it from some parable about Roberto Clemente. We can do an endless list of righteous people like Clemente and Raoul Wallenberg and every soldier who threw himself on a grenade to save his platoon, and they still wouldn't learn anything. So instead of Clemente, let's talk about a player who couldn't learn anything either. I always find it odd that this isn't a more well-known story, because it's so strange, but I guess it was a long time ago and the player is obscure. He is somebody, though, who comes up on the occasional list that you can make of baseball players, in this case, tallest catchers ever. Larry McLean was 6'5", and There still haven't been a lot of backstops of that size. He was born in Canada, but his family later moved to the United States, and he first came to the majors at age 19 with the 1901 edition of the Red Sox, or whatever they were calling themselves at that time. I wish I could tell you it was the Boston Fuzzy Bunny Slippers, but it wasn't. In any case, Larry didn't stick there. He didn't stick in the majors until 1906 with the Cincinnati Reds. That was after he misbehaved his way off the 1903 Cubs and the 1904 Cardinals. See, a big man sometimes has a big thirst, and McLean was a heavy, heavy drinker. Even in the minors, his contracts had clauses in them that demanded that he abstain, because the more he drank, the stupider he got, and the more likely he was to act out. It didn't really work. In 1904, he was with the Cardinals, and he got sent to the minors by his manager, pitcher Kid Nichols, after he went on a spree and jumped in a public fountain. Nichols said, "I can pitch to Larry real good, but I can't manage him worth a damn." His Sabre biography quotes his 1912 manager, Hank O'Day, answering the question of who would catch in a certain game by saying, "The big fella, if he can see them." Still, he stuck with the Reds from 1906 through 1912, and then after a lot of fights and suspensions for breaking training and not showing up during games, another player manager, shortstop Joe Tinker, got rid of him, selling him back to the Cardinals. Before he could even start his second tour with the Cardinals, he broke his arm in an off-season bar fight, something over a fixed billiards game. He escaped prosecution when a witness testified he'd been trying to break up the fight. That was a lie. He was with his brother, Albert. Albert jumped a man named Warren Stoner, got him in a headlock, and held him there while Larry pounded him. Stoner somehow wrestled himself free and hit Larry with a pool cue, breaking his arm, after which a bystander floored Larry with a punch to the jaw. What I want to convey here is something that my grandfather, an old Frenchman, used to say to me while he was pouring out the Cointreau. He would say that alcohol revealed a person's true nature, and that a mean drunk was probably a mean person when he was sober. You just couldn't see it as easily. Well, Larry McLean was a mean drunk, and I don't know if Grandpa was right or wrong, but you can draw your own conclusions. Giants manager John McGraw thought he could work with anybody, no matter how much of a wreck they were off the field. There's an oft-repeated quote about him by the great writer Haywood Broun that McGraw could take kids out of coal mines and wheat fields and make them walk and talk and chatter and play ball with the look of eagles. Maybe. But he was also repeatedly unable to cure the incurable, the addicted, and the perverse, and he paid a very high personal price for that.
Parenthetically, Broun also had a description of McLean. He called him the finest example of early Gothic architecture in the national game today.
In August of 1913, he swapped his former relief ace, Doc Crandall, to the Cardinals for McLean. This actually worked out really well in the short term, because that fall the Giants won the pennant, and their starting catcher, Chief Myers, got hurt and couldn't play after Game 1. McLean stepped in, and he was great. He caught a Christy Mathewson shutout, and he went 6-for-12 at the plate. It was then that Ringlardner wrote this verse about him. Note that I've been pronouncing McLean the way it's spelled, L-E-A-N. Lardner's doggerel treats it as if it's McLean. I'm going to read it the way he wrote it. I don't know what the real answer is, but if you've read Lardner, you know that he wasn't particular about spelling, grammar, or anything else. So I'm going to assume he was just taking liberties and go back to reading it the way I was once we're done with this. In the midst of the season of 1906, the Reds found themselves in their usual fix. They sent for Long Larry and kept the big guy, till Tinker decided the team should go dry. Then back to St. Louis went Larry McLean. The Brewers, meanwhile, having caught up again, but quickly he cleaned them, he drained them quite dry, and got himself traded to Gotham, NY. Now, in the World Series, Long Larry's a star. He'll soon have sufficient to buy his own bar. So brothers, take warning from Larry McLean, and never, no never, touch water again. This is kind of uncomfortable to read, both because it's revelatory of the way alcoholism used to be treated as kind of a joke, and also the lack of awareness by Ringlardner, whose own life would be truncated by alcoholism in the coming years.
McLean stayed with the Giants as the reserve catcher all the way through 1914, and without incident, as far as I can tell. And he was back again in 1915 when, on or about June 6th, McGraw suspended him for excessive drinking after some kind of public binge in Chicago. This is where things got very strange, and McLean was faced with a choice, a turning point, if you will. McGraw initially had suspended McLean for the rest of the season, and then he calmed down and cut the suspension to just 10 days. That still didn't sit well with McLean. He was angry at McGraw, and he was angry at McGraw's chief scout, Dick Kinsella, who he felt had turned him in for this drinking episode. The Giants moved on to St. Louis, McLean going with them. McLean was making noise about jumping to the Federal League's St. Louis Terriers. The Federal League was still a going concern at that point. Maybe it wasn't working out. It's not like McLean, who, for a huge guy, wasn't much of a hitter, would have been that much of a catch. If you remember Andy Allinson from the 1980s, another huge catcher who didn't hit much, I think that's about the model. And so McLean was just stewing. A couple of days go by, and at 11 p.m. one night, after one of the Giants games with the Cardinals, John McGraw and Kinsella were sitting on the porch of the Buckingham Hotel talking. Some of the players were also around, lobby sitting, which is all you had to do at night after a game in 1915. It's kind of a lost art, lobby sitting. McLean and some associates, I don't know that friend is the right word, had just arrived when Kinsella stood up and said to McGraw, "I'm going to bed." "Not unless you're carried there," McLean shouted, and he attacked the two men with a lead pipe. McGraw deflected McLean's arm as he swung at Kinsella, saving the scout from having his skull cracked. Kinsella recovered quickly, picked up a chair, and smashed it over McLean's head. A half dozen players then waded in to rout McLean's associates. Kinsella picked up the leg from the shattered chair and was going to work on McLean when the catcher fought his way free, ran outside, and jumped on the running board of a passing car full of women, scaring the hell out of them and begging to be taken away. And with that, he was gone. That was it for Larry McLean in the major leagues. McGraw said he was done, and it didn't take too much for a player to be blackballed in those days, particularly when he really wasn't worth the trouble. When your life hits in a deer, a low point, when you find yourself doing things that are incontrovertibly self-destructive, do you reassess? Do you try to rescue yourself? Or do you just keep doubling down, going on in the same old way and hoping that you'll get different results? That was McLean's way. He had just 6 years to live. On March 24th, 1921, he and a friend, a semi-pro ball player, were in what was either a Boston speakeasy or a near beer bar. This was Prohibition, so establishments had to be cagey about what they were selling. When, for the second night in a row, he started harassing the bartender. When McLean made a move to climb over the bar, boosted by his friend, the bartender pulled a gun and shot both of them. Hit in the stomach, McLean stumbled outside and died on the sidewalk. The friend lingered for some days, then he died too. If life offers you a hint, and being thrashed in a hotel lobby by John McGraw is definitely a hint, you ought to take it. But you see, some people are incapable of learning, ever. I'll be back with Jesse Spector in just a moment. He covers the Colorado Rockies, he covers the New Jersey Devils, he covers the MLB playoffs, he covers the waterfront. He was co-created by Jerry Siegel and Bernard Bailey in More Fun Comics number 51. He's the hardest working man in show business, Jesse Spector. How are you, Jesse?
I'm good, Steve. How are you?
I'm functional. I'm a little bit harried because as we're talking today, and this happens every October, this is Monday, and there are 16 hours of baseball roughly today, pending various rain delays in both Boston and New York. So it's a bit of a long day, and I'm grateful that I'm no longer doing the SB Nation thing where I had to like do hot takes on every single thing that happened in every single game or delegate that to other people or be aware of just the need to constantly update with GIFs and things like that. I can be more of a spectator and be analytic, but it gets to be too much of a good thing. How about you?
Yeah, I'd say that's partially the case, but partially I do miss it sometimes. One of the great things about not having a full-time job and going the freelance route is that you can't just be called at a random moment to say, hey, react to X. But I did miss it the other night when I wanted to just rip into Joe Girardi, because that would have been a lot of fun to do because he deserved it. And I don't dislike Joe Girardi, but that was clown shoes game two of the Yankees in Cleveland. And the way that he let that get away was just really unacceptable. You know, you have these challenges, you use them. His whole, I don't want to interrupt the pitcher's rhythm. Well, later in that same game, you challenged a ball that was thrown into the camera well while Aroldis Chapman was pitching in a tie game. Like, come on, dude. We can see through that. You messed up. Own it. He finally did, and then he got booed before game three by the Yankee Stadium crowd, which was really something. Like, you don't see that in the playoffs, but there we were. That was something else. But generally, yeah, I'm happy to stick to writing about the games that I'm doing and not have to worry about, you know, getting called off the couch to do other stuff.
I kind of enjoy that aspect of it sometimes. Back when the New York Sun was a thing, I was a columnist for that paper. For a 8 o'clock deadline, they close really early. Mm-hmm. And for an 8 o'clock deadline, they would tend to approve topics about six. And sometimes they would call audibles because the A columnist was Tim Marchman, now more of Deadspin fame. And I was kind of the B columnist. So he got the national stuff and I tended to get the local stuff. And sometimes there'd be an overlap. So they might approve my topic and it might be a Yankees or Mets topic. And then they'd come back to me and say, Tim really wants to do that one. Can you back off of it and do something else? And by the way, there's only an hour left to deadline now that we've gotten back to you on this. And it was fun to do. It was stressful. And I used to literally sweat sometimes just trying to, you know, get 1,000 words in or whatever the news hole was that day. Sometimes it was larger, sometimes it was smaller. But I enjoyed the challenge of it, of writing something coherent and interesting on that tight a deadline.
Yeah, that's something. And that's a lot like writing, you know, a game column, but just about not a game necessarily. That's wild. I can't necessarily imagine doing that regularly. You know, there have been times when I've done it and put something together like that, but that's a crush. And I gotta say, I'm really surprised that a paper that had an 8 o'clock deadline for a morning edition is no longer with us. That's really surprising here in 2017.
It was also a super right-wing paper in New York, which is not a super right-wing place. So that might have been part of it. And of course, it was probably a quixotic thing to start a newspaper at that point anyway. But I enjoyed the work and I enjoyed doing that kind of stunt writing. And of course, I was younger then. I don't know how well I would like it now. And it did require me to cancel any evening plans that I might have on a frequent basis.
But you'd be free by 8.
Well, that's true. I want to get back to this Girardi thing because I wrote a piece for FanRag this morning because I was set off. And you can Google this. Just Google the words Joe Girardi and redemption. And you also get Masahiro Tanaka and redemption and Aaron Judge and redemption. And it's just a very overused cliche term. And one columnist for the Daily News wrote, can Joe Girardi redeem himself for game two? I don't think so. And look, it was an egregious thing and an egregious oversight, not going for the review there, especially given the two key pieces of evidence, which is one, Gary Sanchez was telling him to go for it, and the other that the batter, Chisenhall, had ostensibly been hit in the pinky by a baseball and didn't react to it even slightly. That's problematic. It's also evidence of the rigidity of Joe Girardi, which is not a new thing. But it bothers me that this is a guy who's been here since 2008. His strengths and weaknesses are well known. I don't know if this is a career-ending thing if the Yankees wash out of this series because a lot of other things go on, but it's being treated that way. It just bothers me because even as recently as October 3rd, he managed, I think, one of the best games he's ever managed in nursing the pitching staff through the wildcard play-in game after Luis Severino blew up.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. And you know, you can talk about Aaron Judge the same way, the great game that he had against Minnesota before having, with the exception of his home run robbery of Francisco Lindor, but at the plate, a terrible ALDS. And no, redemption is really overused thing. And no, I don't think that what happened in Cleveland is career ending or Yankees tenure ending for Joe Girardi. If it is the case that he's not brought back next year, it is the compilation of, you know, negatives overall outweighing positives, including, and this is where that plays into it, not making the challenge is a mistake. It's a bad mistake. It cost them a playoff game. You can't overlook that. And to me, though, that's not why you get rid of a manager, because you're in a series, Joe Girardi and Terry Francona, two excellent managers. And I would call Girardi an excellent manager in general. He's one of the better ones. Somebody's going to lose. And it happened last year. You know, Terry Francona's managing against Joe Maddon. And Terry Francona screwed up in Game 5. He left Trevor Bauer in too long. You know, I had written a column. If I was smart enough to see beforehand, you know, you should not let Trevor Bauer face this Cubs lineup a third time, and had asked Francona about that being a possibility between Games 4 and 5. And he kind of dismissed it. And then he left him in. And he winds up coughing it up in game five, and Cleveland winds up losing game six and game seven. But to me, that series was lost in game five. Francona was the guy who messed up and made the bad mistake. It's going to happen. It comes down to, and same, you know, pitcher versus hitter. Good pitcher versus good hitter. Somebody's going to make a mistake, or somebody's going to get outdone, outworked. It happens. There's a winner and a loser. That's the way sports works. The problem for Girardi is how it happened and not listening to Gary Sanchez and the relationship between Girardi and Sanchez, who should be a superstar player for this team for a long time to come. There's clearly issues there of Girardi not trusting him in that moment, not trusting him defensively. He could have shut it down so many times. All of that talk about, oh, man, the Yankees should maybe start Arsene Roman. He could have very easily at any point said, no, Gary Sanchez is my catcher. He has a lot of defensive strengths. He calls a good game. The pitchers like throwing to him. He's got a good arm. Just happens to be pretty lousy at blocking balls. But we can live with that for all the positives that he brings us. Nobody's strengths are 100% across the board. That would have been fine. Where you get into it, and then you know, you have Aroldis Chapman with the Instagram comment, like, you have the question of, does Girardi have the full faith and confidence of this Yankee team? And that's the question that has to be asked about whether or not he comes back next year. Not, did he make a mistake that cost them a playoff game? Because those mistakes happen to multiple managers, managers better and worse than Girardi, across the playoffs every year.
Chapman thing I dismiss a little bit because he also lashed out at Joe Maddon going out the door with the Cubs. And look, he struggled and Girardi demoted him for a bit. And so I don't think that Chapman is exactly unbiased. The thing about Sanchez is interesting, and what it makes me wonder is if Girardi can't reflect on that without also indicting his own career, because this situation played itself out with Girardi and Jorge Posada under Joe Torre. And, you know, there was a period there of a couple of years where supposedly Girardi was tutoring Posada, and Posada was never a great defensive catcher, but he was nearly tutored into his 30s. Posada, for a guy who never caught a knuckleballer, had a crazy number of pass balls and wild pitches every year. And of course, the dividing line between those is thin, so I kind of lump them together. He was not good at blocking balls. And neither is Sanchez, sure, but, you know, a home run is four total bases, a wild pitch is one. As you said, it more than evens out over the course of a season. And yeah, somebody might move up a base in a playoff game, but he might also hit one out, which Austin Romine is not going to do.
And is Gary Sanchez probably a DH at some point in his career? Yeah, but that's years and years from now. And his arm is good enough. His relationship with the pitchers certainly appears to be good enough. We don't have the full insight on that, but it's something of a no-brainer. And to let it get to the point where it got in the last few weeks of the season is on the manager. And that's something that was always talked about, you know, Joe Torre's excellence in New York was the way that he handled the media. And I didn't always love it when you would go to a Yankee game and sit in Joe Torre's dugout scrum at the time. That was something. The years before they moved to the press conference room, you have a scenario where Joe Torre would sit, just take a seat in the dugout, and everybody would be crowded around him. And it was physically taxing to stand there with your arm outstretched and in some kind of awkward position hanging off the roof of the dugout with your other arm to try to make sure that you got those quotes. And he would go off on these long, rambling stories, but the press ate it up. And he didn't face those kinds of scenarios and situations the way that Girardi has. And it's not the first time that Girardi's been through this sort of thing. And it's not a strength of his the way that it was for Torre to be able to deflect the same way, because he's not as folksy, I guess.
No, he's not at all. He's very uptight.
I mean, is it as simple as that he's just not as warm and therefore doesn't get the same kind of benefit from the media? I don't know exactly what it is, but his relationship there is definitely different, and that goes somewhat into the weaknesses crate for him. And I don't know who they would replace him with, and I think that's when you're dealing with a team that's at this position, that's in the playoffs and really is on the way up. They might take a step back next year, because I do expect that they'll do what they can to get under the tax so that with this young core that they've developed, they can go full bore into that huge free agent class 2018-2019 and set themselves up for a decade or so coming out of that. You need to know if you're going to get rid of this guy, who you're going to replace him with.
I mentioned this on another episode of the show, and I don't remember if it was you and I talking, but I was in many of those scrums at different times over the years. And I do not mind admitting that I never heard a single word that Joe Torre said. Now, I learned eventually that if you stuck your recording device behind his head somewhere and just hoped you would get it back after, you might do okay. But if you were on the outside, he spoke so quietly. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, batting practice was going on. The organist was noodling. Jets were going by overhead. And he intentionally, I really think this was like a passive aggressive thing. Somebody would say, like, how is Tino Martinez's hamstring doing today? And all you would hear is, and I don't know that he was audible to anybody, but that 100 reporters were probably embarrassed to ask each other, can you hear that? Or say, speak up, Joe. And I never caught a thing. And I sat through, I don't know how many of those. I mean, not a ton. I wasn't a beat guy. I would parachute in every once in a while when I was working with Yes. But it was a complete waste of time every single time I did it.
This is Alternative Universe Steve interrupting himself to say it's time for a break. We'll be back right after this word from our sponsors.
Yeah, pretty much. I remember kind of angling for position. It's sort of also the way that I wound up in my favorite picture of me covering baseball of all time, which is me in a dugout in a very similar scenario, sitting on the top of the dugout bench next to Barry Bonds in Houston. And I just sort of staked out a spot and I was sitting there and Bonds came and sat right next to me. And I kind of realized where Bonds would naturally wind up sitting and position myself there so that I would be able to hear him. And that was due to having been in, and yeah, at that point in my career, I was not covering the Yankees regularly, but I had done a few of those Torre dugout sessions. So I had that experience going for me, and that's how I wound up right next to Barry Bonds, basically staring at his ears for 15 minutes. Why are his ears so tiny? And it was really, you know, the fact that his head was gigantic and not of a size that it necessarily should have been, because I saw Bonds, you know, years later. I ran into him in a hallway in the 2014 World Series on and just the most amazing bathroom run of all time, because I was in the auxiliary press box in San Francisco, and to go to the bathroom, you had to either wait in a giant men's room line with the hoi polloi, which is fine, I don't care, but you're going to miss time. And I took the calculated notion that I would save time by just sort of going to where the press box was on the suite level and using a suite level bathroom. So that was what I did. And in the hallway, there's Barry Bonds, and I get into the elevator, and there's Willie Mays and his dog. So that's my brush with greatness, because I had to go to the bathroom during the middle of a World Series game.
I would like to see that movie or that TV series, the Willie Mays and his dog series. I don't know the name of the dog, Astro or Scooby-Doo or something, but the Say Hey Kid and Scooby on the road solving mysteries. I think that would be pretty good.
You know that you're an all-time great when you can bring your dog to the World Series. They don't just let anybody do that. Okay. Yeah, sure. You want to bring your dog, Mr. Mays? Go right ahead.
Speaking of Barry Bonds' head, this is what baseball has done to me in that, you know, a couple of weeks back, Ken Burns' Vietnam series was running on PBS, and I watched it and enjoyed it greatly. And there's a good deal of it that appropriately is devoted to the Kennedy administration, and they're the ones who really deepened our involvement in it prior to the assassination and LBJ taking over. But Kennedy, because of his various illnesses, his bad back, his Addison's disease, and so on, was on steroids. And so as they chronologically went through the sequence of Kennedy's years in the Senate, running for the presidency, in the presidency, you could see his head blow up like a balloon. And every iconic statue of JFK has that big steroid head in it, and I can never look at the guy the same way because the president was juicing. To get back to Girardi for one second, the thing that I find interesting about his explanations for not calling for that instant replay, and not the fake one about the not disrupting the pitcher's rhythm, but the real one about how they just couldn't move fast enough according to their normal procedures to get the slam dunk proof that they needed to trigger the instant replay review. And this is the way they've done it all year, and they've been very successful about it, is that it really is emblematic of Joe Girardi's whole approach to everything. This is somebody
who likes to eliminate all possibility of improvisation from every game. And I'm referring to the kind of really idiotic things that he'll say sometimes about, well, I couldn't go to that pitcher in the eighth inning. He's not the eighth inning guy. The problem is that Girardi's the guy who designated him the eighth inning guy. He's the one who can undesignate him the eighth inning guy. And there is no ironclad contract that he signed with the commissioner of baseball or anybody else that says that he can't use that pitcher in any inning that he wants to use him in, because he's free. He's free to do whatever he wants. But in his mind, that is something that you cannot break. And I think that what happened in that replay situation was that similarly, he had a series of checkpoints that he has to go through to trigger a replay challenge. And the game just moved too fast for him to do it, and he blew the opportunity. And it's just, this is not necessarily a good thing. It's not somebody I'd certainly like to live with in terms of that kind of anal retentiveness or rigidity or lack of flexibility. And maybe it's him recognizing his limitations. I don't know. But it just seemed to me that everybody's acting all shocked about it, whereas it was just totally predictable from the point of view of having watched Joe Girardi for 10 years.
He's forever the binder man.
Right.
That's who he is. And I can accept that that's part of your nature sometimes, but then you do things like bring in Aroldis Chapman for a 5-out save in game 3 because David Robertson let a guy get on base. David Robertson's natural environment is pitching with dudes on base. Like, that is what he does. So I didn't buy that as a decision. And the risk in bringing in Chapman for the 5-out save is that somewhere in the mid-20s pitch-wise, he starts to lose it a little bit. And we saw that in the World Series last year when Joe Maddon tried to extend him and it almost cost them the World Series. You need to know who Aroldis Chapman is. He's not Mariano Rivera. He's not Dellin Betances. He's not David Robertson. Those are guys that can give you a little bit more length. And when you try to do that with Chapman, you're really playing with fire, and almost got burned in Game 3. Because I think that they were in a position, Tommy Canley only started to warm up during the last batter that Chapman faced. And if Chapman doesn't manage to get that last out, if it's a hit instead, the game is tied. And now you're bringing in Tommy Canley to face a situation where the go-ahead run, potential winning run, is in scoring position. And another run is on base, and things can just completely fall apart on you. You might lose that game 6-1 and get swept out of the playoffs if there's a little bit different contact on that last ball of the game. I think that Girardi really got away with one there, and he got away with something that was going outside of his normal bounds. And that's where you can be furious. If a guy is playing all the time by, I gotta play it by the book, I gotta play it straight down the line, then you accept that that's sort of who he is. That's what this guy's makeup is. I think that Ned Yost is a decent example of that. He doesn't really mess around too much with that. And he won a pennant in a World Series pretty much doing that. He figured out what his way was that he wanted to do, and he did it. Girardi has that in him, but he also will freelance from time to time. And sometimes by necessity, like the wild card game against Minnesota, but sometimes out of a choice, like saying that you're going to yank David Robertson from the middle of an inning when all he's done is let a runner get to first base, and he's perfectly comfortable in general in that sort of situation.
Well, you're hitting on another aspect of Joe Girardi, the many-faced god, in that, and this is something I used to talk about frequently during my Yes Network days, that he has an alter ego, and I used to call him Coffee Joe. He's a very caffeinated version of Joe Girardi, and I think in retrospect that this is true of almost all managers in the postseason. They feel like they have to do something. They can't just let the game play out, especially because they are going to get criticized for leaving a guy in one batter too long or not pinch hitting or not bunting. And so you see all of these strategies being employed at a frequency that you would not see normally in the regular season, whether it's the addition of the defensive substitutes and pinch runners that are on the roster now instead of the extra pitchers. The Yankees don't have one, by the way. The Yankees carry 12 pitchers, but on the whole, they get active because they don't want to let the players decide the games for them. They want to decide the games for them. And I think it's not just Girardi. It's a very human thing. You're helpless at that point. Casey Stengel used to say, this is what drives managers nuts. You prepare, you make your plans, you work, and then you have to turn the game over to idiots like these. And I mean, I don't know that Girardi's that negative about it, but I think it's the same impulse, the impulse to control the uncontrollable. And that's where you see managers start to do things that they're not comfortable doing, asking players to do things they don't normally ask them to do during the regular season. And it leads to us getting to some unusual, weird results and some tension that we wouldn't normally get. But I think it's the good manager who kind of stays within himself at this time of year and just lets things happen.
I think so. I think that there's also a difference in managing the playoffs versus managing the regular season, where managing the regular season really is about managing the clubhouse and managing with a long-term plan and getting through 162 games over 6 months to give yourself the best chance to reach the postseason. Whereas once you get there, each game and each decision within each game is so magnified. Like, people go nuts at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on a regular basis, you know, April through September, about, oh, I can't believe that this is the lineup today. But there's generally a fairly explicable reason for it and how it fits into a bigger picture. There is no bigger picture in the playoffs. You're managing for each one individual game, and you want to win that game, and you can't really think about tomorrow, maybe unless you have a lead, and then you can sort of pull back the chain a little bit. Say, okay, you know, we got a 2-0 lead in this series. I don't have to push my best reliever to get extra outs. I can, you know, make sure that if it's going to be this way, I'll die with somebody else today and still have the chance tomorrow. And you're playing with that advantage. But each decision is certainly magnified in the playoffs, and it becomes a much bigger part of the manager's job than it is during the regular season. And I think that especially in 2015, that's where Terry Collins got exposed. I think that Terry Collins was a really, really good manager for the Mets in terms of handling the clubhouse and handling the media and all the stuff that you need to do during the regular season. And no secret that he struggled on early 21st century in-game managerial work. And this year, the clubhouse and that situation got away from him a bit, and everything just went sideways on the Mets in general. But in 2015, Collins had a great regular season, not necessarily as a matter of pushing buttons in games, because there was still the same frustration. You can ask any Mets fan about exactly how that all went and whether they had the best faith in Terry Collins, you know, over the course of that season, making moves. A lot of them worked, and that helps over the course of the year. But where he got exposed was how he handled the bullpen, and especially then how he handled Matt Harvey in the postseason, and that came back to bite him.
That's true. I feel obligated to point out the other thing was his resistance to young players, and that mm-hmm. he cheerfully vented a full year of Michael Conforto's career and then was prepared to do it again this year until injuries didn't allow him to. And if Conforto hadn't just kept hitting like crazy until the point that he got hurt, I have no doubt he would have been back on the bench for Alejandro Daza or somebody like that. But I think that's true. And you're right. The big difference in the postseason is that with the notable exception of Walt Alston with Mike Marshall in 1974 pitching 200 innings out of the bullpen, you're not going to ride Andrew Miller for 6 months a year the way that Madden rode him Terry Francona rode him in the playoffs last year and actually overdid it. I was thinking that was one other mistake that he made, using him in the one game where he had the big lead and didn't have to. And then Miller was kind of out of gas after that point, and I think it affected things badly in the subsequent games. But
and Miller gave up the home. It was game four where he brought him in, and Miller gave up the home run there and kind of showed that it was the first time he had ever given up a run in the playoffs in his career.
Right.
And then he winds up giving up a home run. And was it in game seven that he gave up another home run? Yeah, it was, because they fell behind further there. Yeah, I think that Miller, I don't know if he would ever admit it, but he probably did run out of gas at the end of that World Series.
And I think psychologically there was something to showing that he was vulnerable, that he could be defeated. This was the Death Star has an unshielded exhaust part for us to exploit.
I think that that does play a role. I don't know exactly, you know, how that plays out in the remainder of the Yankees series with Cleveland, but Greg Bird hitting a home run off of Andrew Miller, you know, when Miller hadn't allowed a home run to a lefty since June and had only given up the one all year to Cody Bellinger. I think that is a big deal. And I think that is something that has an influence on maybe not so much the psyche of Cleveland, but the psyche of the Yankees, that they're not dead and that they can get to Cleveland's best guy.
I was just thinking about, this is 70 years ago, right now, you were talking about both stupid manager tricks and catchers and Gary Sanchez and all that, that in the 1947 World Series, The Yankees manager was Bucky Harris. He had a young catcher named Yogi Berra. The Dodgers were running wild, Jackie Robinson in particular, on Yogi Berra. Yogi didn't want to be behind the plate anymore. He was being shown up so badly. He got pushed to left field in that series. In the most famous game of that series, which was game 4, Bill Bevins had a no-hitter going late. He was walking the ballpark. He obviously stayed in because back then you didn't yank people in the middle of a no-hitter, even if they'd thrown 200 pitches. And somewhere in there, in this famous winning rally that the Dodgers had against Bevins, the famous call with Red Barber, here comes the tying run and here comes the winning run, that Harris intentionally walked Pete Reiser, who was actually a hospital case. He was concussed. He was broken. He actually couldn't hit. And yet he was sent up to the plate as kind of a desperation move, and he got intentionally walked and ended up scoring. I don't remember if it was the tying run or the winning run. But the point is that what got Harris ultimately fired a year later was not that decision, which is one of the worst in the history of the World Series, probably, but that he couldn't commit to Yogi Berra being the catcher. He kept, throughout the 1948 regular season, kept pushing him to the outfield and using other catchers. And the Yankees knew that that guy's value was going to be behind the plate. He was going to be an incredible hitter for a catcher, maybe not so incredible a hitter for a left fielder or right fielder. And they knew that young catchers, sometimes they need some time to work things out. Because, I mean, with the exception of Posada, have you ever heard of an old catcher who didn't have a reputation as a great handler of pitchers?
Maybe Piazza.
True.
The rap on Piazza was really his arm, more than anything else. Whereas Posada, it was definitely the handling of pitchers. I don't know exactly how it shook out for Piazza as far as his relationship with pitchers. I don't remember hearing the pitchers couldn't stand throwing to him, or that guys needed personal catchers the way that they did when Posada was there because pitchers just couldn't get along with him. But yeah, Piazza's the guy that comes to mind in that regard. But what do they have in common? Amazing, amazing Hall of Fame level hitters.
Right, exactly. I mean, there's just a knee-jerk thing that happens in baseball, which is that Sandy Leone or somebody like that who's catching for the Red Sox almost as we speak. I mean, those guys who don't hit get these reputations as great glove men, and the guys who do hit always have to constantly prove themselves.
If they can't hit, they've got to be there for some reason, right? It can't just be that they're willing to strap on that gear. It seems to me that Clayton Kershaw has continued to do okay since AJ Ellis got traded, I think. I don't think Clayton Kershaw's exactly fallen off the face of the earth since then. It's worked out okay for him. So maybe that's all a little bit overblown sometimes. Maybe, just a little. Meanwhile, as we record this, I'm watching the Red Sox and Astros, and Hanley Ramirez just hit a ball about a mile and a half, and it was just a little bit foul, and he was walking backwards up the first baseline, and I wonder if he just needed to do the Carlton Fisk a little bit. Fisk kept his fair by using his body that way, and Dave Henderson gave it a lot more spirited backwards run during the 86 World Series, but Hanley was unable to, in this situation, make that happen, and I think that I credit that to his poor body language.
It's funny you mentioned Dave Henderson, because I thought of him yesterday. That would be in game 3 of this series. When Josh Reddick boosted the home run out late, I thought, you know, they finally got the karma evened out for Dave Henderson knocking Bobby Gritch's home run. Bobby Gritch's only postseason home run of his career, I think, was actually knocked out by Dave Henderson, a great player who just didn't do well in those situations for some reason, by which I mean Gritch, not Henderson. But finally, however many years later, it evened out.
Doesn't necessarily seem to be the way that things are going to work out, I think, because this is a flawed Red Sox team, and they had flaws throughout the season, and I think that the winning masked it a lot for them. But you get to the playoffs, and sometimes you can win anyway. I think it's such a result-based thing of how you see a team and their flaws. Like, the Red Sox have been flawed, but if they came out and scored a million runs against everybody the Astros threw at them, you wouldn't be looking at those flaws the same way. It's the flaws that really only get exposed when you lose, and you're like, yeah, that was a problem all along. Why didn't we think more about that?
Well, they didn't hit all year, and now everyone has noticed that they were last on the circuit in home runs. And it's a problem when you have an offense like the Astros, who can put the ball in play and do scary things with it, and you can't respond in kind. And I think that on paper, at least, the Red Sox have a pretty good advantage in pitching. But again, That advantage in pitching is compiled throughout the regular season against not the Astros, but against everybody, all comers, the good offenses, the bad offenses.
Yeah.
And you can't just say, well, they're going to carry that over against the best offense in baseball. But I think what you can say is the same thing is true of the offense. And they didn't hit home runs against the good pitching staffs, and they didn't hit home runs against the bad pitching staffs. And if we've seen anything in this postseason, and I was going to mention this in a minute, just by my calculation, there have been, prior to this game, 37 home runs in about 800 postseason at-bats so far, which includes pitchers, it includes whoever. Like, I mean, there are a lot of balls flying out. The Diamondbacks, for example, have hit 6 home runs in about 60 at-bats. If you can't respond in kind, I think you're in trouble.
I think home runs do mean more in the playoffs as well, and having that ability, and it's something that I wrote a couple of years ago when the Astros first went to the playoffs. That was what made them a very dangerous team in the playoffs, and they wound up beating the Yankees because of home runs. That lineup put them, and their ability to hit home runs 1 through 9, put them in a lot better place. And I think that's one of the things about this Yankee team, too, is that Greg Bird might be a 25 home run a year guy annually, and he hit 9 this year in very limited action. And he's a guy that hits 7th for them. Todd Frazier hits 9th, and he's a guy who had a down year this year from a power standpoint, but still hit more than 20 home runs and should strike fear in you to be able to do that. And he's got that in his bag of tricks. He hit 40 a year ago.
Right.
The Yankees are a scary lineup that way, that everybody in that lineup can take you deep. And it's just not you can't pitch to that lineup the same way that you can pitch to the Red Sox lineup, even though the Red Sox have several good hitters. They have a lot of guys that are less threatening and who you can do more things with, and it presents fewer problems to a playoff staff, because so much of the time in the playoffs, it's not the big rallies, and it is the home runs. That the home runs are sort of the inflection points of games a lot of the time. And because if you see a rally brewing, managers are much more willing to just go to the bullpen and put a stop to it. And I think that
right.
That does make a difference. And just going back to the Red Sox for a second, you talked about them being good with pitching on paper. That's my dog.
Wow, he scared the heck out of me. I was not expecting
that.
I
don't know what he's barking at. so Yuppie makes a guest appearance here. But the Red Sox, they're good on paper, but you look at it and, well, David Price is a bullpen guy in October, and Rick Porcello is not anywhere close to the level that he was on, you know, when he was winning the Cy Young. And Eduardo Rodriguez is what Eduardo Rodriguez is. He's not the guy that you necessarily project to be a top level starting guy yet. Doug Fister did nice for them down the stretch, but at the same time, he's still the guy that he's not the guy of a couple of years ago, you know, when he was one of the better starters in the league. He's Doug Fister 2017. And Chris Sale, at some point, we're going to have to figure out exactly what it is that he fades in August and September every year. And he was pretty touchable in his first October start. So I think that the Red Sox rotation is not as good in real life as it is on paper with the names that make it up.
The issue is the early recourse to the bullpen. So if you're not going to hit home runs and you've got to create rallies by chaining up hits, if you can't make contact, you're not going to do that. So the benefit is the home run. Obviously, you score in one stroke. You've made contact. You hit the ball out. There's a run on the board. But if you have to go walk, single, double, bunt, whatever, that's not going to happen most of the time against a Chapman or a Miller or a guy like that, because it's just too difficult to do unless one of those guys just has a total off day.
Yeah, and the strikeouts, there's so much more of a propensity for strikeouts at this time of year, because you're seeing those pitchers, and in today's game, everybody that you're bringing out of the bullpen that's throwing 95 is striking dudes out, and generally, that does make it tougher to string those rallies together. And the idea that a manager is going to have pretty much a short leash for any given pitcher, because if that guy doesn't have it that day, you want to get him out as soon as possible. You're not messing around. You're not saving the bullpen for another day. You worry about the next day, and who's thrown a small enough amount that they can be fresh.
I'm still just trying to recover from Yuppie's appearance there. I thought there was an outbreak of lycanthropy at your end of the line.
He's sitting next to me on the couch. He's been sitting here the whole time. and just suddenly barked and then went back to lying there. He's now looking at me because I think he knows that I'm talking about him.
Right. It's not an anti-Semitic thing, is it?
Certainly not.
I wanted to ask you how you felt about all the home runs, because I've seen people go back and forth about this, and nobody said anything to me particularly, but I've seen other people kind of be accused of being joyless, no fun people by decrying the sheer number of home runs hit this year. But I have to admit, I do feel a little jaded about it. And when games are turning on like Daniel Descalso home runs, I feel like, and I'm not saying Daniel Descalso is utterly incapable of hitting a home run in the postseason, that certainly there have been less likely home runs in the postseason, but it does feel like they come a little too easily. You know, when we're watching Clayton Kershaw just every 3 seconds turning around to watch the ball sail out of the park, I'm not sure that's as much bad pitching or even good hitting as it just is that the ball's a little rabbity this year.
Yeah, the ball's a little rabbity this year. That's fine. I like home runs. I can't believe that there are people out there that complain that there are too many home runs. It's just, why is that a bad thing? It's the most, like, yeah, a triple, I guess, is the most exciting play in baseball because it's more extended and you're looking to see if the guy's going to make it and it's taking crazy hops and everybody's running around. The home runs are awesome. I don't understand, unless you are actually a pitcher, who doesn't like home runs? I don't get it. And yeah, is it a little weird to see Daniel Descalso do it? Sure. But that's one game, and didn't Pat Borders have a playoff series? Pat Borders was a World Series MVP.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff happens in the playoffs. Jim Leyritz was a ludicrously mediocre player over the course of his career. Couldn't find a position. Didn't hit all that much. You know, he was a spare part. And yet, hits a huge home run against Wohlers in 96 that really changes the shape of that series. Has a big home run in 95 against the Mariners that seemed like it might send the Yankees on their way until, you know, the three games happened in Seattle, and it very much did not. Had a couple other big home runs in his career and sort of got a reputation as, like, playoff home run guy Jim Leyritz. That happens, and I'm cool with that. I like that, you know, that's part of the drama of the playoffs, is that one swing of the bat at any time can turn everything upside down. And, you know, certainly that's true of games during the regular season as well, but it means so much more in the playoffs, and there's such a spotlight on it, and the joy of the guy trotting around the bases, that whether it's Aaron Judge getting all pumped up when he hit his in the wild card game, or whether it's Daniel Descalso in the other wild card game hitting a huge home run. It's the joy of those guys, the sheer dejection of the pitchers. Home runs are great, and I will argue in favor of home runs until I'm blue in the face.
Let me try this a different way. When I first learned about baseball, and this is before Bill James, this is before sabermetrics, so everything I'm about to say is more or less bullshit, but I think for illustrative purposes, I'm going to say it anyway. So when I was first taught about baseball and told about how you make up a batting order, your number one hitter is a guy who's fast and can run the bases. Your second place hitter is a bat handler who can hit and run. Your third place guy is your best all-around hitter who can make contact and drive the ball. Your cleanup hitter is your hulking power guy. And onward, your fifth place hitter is maybe a power guy who strikes out more than your fourth place hitter. I never did.
Fifth is the RBI guy.
There you go.
I always love
the RBI guy. I never did learn what sixth was. Sixth was a guy who's neither Coke nor Pepsi. He's neither chocolate nor vanilla. He's just there. Seventh is a low average power hitter again. Eighth is Rafael Santana. And whatever. Now most of that turned out to be wrong. And we learned fairly quickly after that it was wrong. But now I just feel like if you had the same discussion, it's so frequent with the home runs that now you would just say, well, your leadoff is a guy who hits the ball into the seats, and your second place hitter is a guy who hits the ball into the seats, and your third place hitter is a guy who hits the ball into the seats, and so on. And I guess what I'm trying to say is I miss Tony Gwynn. I miss the variety of different flavors of hitters who did different things, and it wasn't just about hitting the ball over the fences.
Steve interrupting himself again for one last salute to capitalism, after which we'll wrap this puppy up. We'll be back in just a moment.
I would argue that that still exists. I think that we still do have that. There, you know, yeah, Jose Altuve hits the ball into the seats more than guys of his type of past generations. But he's still an amazing hitter for average. And mean, there's Brett Gardner's in the world. There's Jackie Bradley Jr.'s in the world. There's Ben Zobrist. There's, you know, all variety of different kind of hitters who get the job done different ways with or without hitting the ball over the fence. It's just that, yeah, home runs in general are up. But I think that the question is, going forward, was this a one-year thing with the ball, or is this how it's going to be from now on? Because, you know, we've had years like this before. In 1987, Wade Boggs hit 28 home runs, yep, which is way more than he hit in any other year. And that didn't change Wade Boggs into not being Wade Boggs. He remained the same dude, sending doubles off of the Green Monster right up until the moment that he went to the Yankees and just started dunking singles into the gigantic left field at the old Yankee Stadium. If the chance of seeing a home run goes up by 10% just across the board, not a bad thing. And honestly, you know, for the amount that the game is slowed down by, and this is such a point of emphasis that, again, I don't understand. I don't have a problem with it if the game takes 3 hours, or 3.5 hours. I'm here for it. I want more baseball.
I'm with you on that.
Like, yeah, but, and could the pace be improved sometimes? Yeah. At the same time, strikeouts take more pitches, and guys now strike out more because of the style of hitting that we see and because of the style of pitching that we see. There's more strikeouts in the game than there have ever been, and strikeouts take a while. But the other thing that slows the game down is runners on the bases. And home runs clear the bases. So home runs are here to help speed up the game is my partial argument on why home runs are good, I guess. I just don't see the death of the quality hitter for average. And you can even see that on a team like the Rockies, where, yeah, they have Nolan Arenado as a pure power guy, and Charlie Blackman hits a bunch of home runs, but he's still pretty close to a traditional leadoff guy. And DJ LeMahieu is a slap-hitting guy who, you know, found his way into a batting title. Yeah, in part because of Coors, but hey, that's where he plays. And, you know, I don't see that. They're not a team imagined in the Blake Street Bombers mold. They're a team imagined as something else that's going to hit home runs. And I think that if you're just looking at it, that, yeah, there's going to be more home runs and more guys are capable of hitting them, then fine. I don't see a fundamental change of teams playing for the home run and of teams just sitting back and waiting for the home run. I think they're still trying to get those rallies and trying to score runs, but it is magnified in the playoffs that those rallies are harder to come by for all of the reasons that we discussed, and home runs are more prevalent. So it seems all the more so, especially in a home run heavy year, that this is the way that it is. But I don't see it as a total sea change in baseball that we're just going to see either home run or strikeout or walk, three true outcomes all the time, forever and ever and ever, and nothing else. Fielders may as well just go home, except for two guys that you put out in front of the outfield walls to rob any balls that were close to home runs, but not quite.
I don't know if I'm saying that, but when you put it that way, it feels almost like what I'm saying is something intuitive. Like there's a sense, and this could be entirely subjective, that mixes off just a little. And maybe that's all that it is. I don't see it going the way that you're talking about either, all the way to the three true outcomes and nothing else. I don't think it's nearly there. But I feel like if dead center, the perfect mix is at zero, the needles move just a little bit more to the right than I feel comfortable with. And again, that could just be my idiosyncratic view of the thing.
The way that I see it is that it's painted a lot, and I'm not saying that you're painting it this way. It's painted a lot as, oh, this is new Coke baseball. Bring back Coke Classic. Whereas the way that I see it is that it's like, you know, if Diet Coke just changed which artificial sweetener they're using, like if they went from, I don't know what they use, if they went from like Splenda to Stevia or whatever, I don't know what they use. Like, they just change it, and it doesn't really taste dramatically differently to a lot of people, but it does to some, and to the people who it does taste different to. 80% of people think, oh, this Diet Coke tastes the same. 10% are like, huh, Diet Coke is better now. And then another 10% are like, ugh, I'm never drinking Diet Coke again. I think that it's more that than new Coke.
All I can say is I use Splenda all the time. I think Stevia tastes like rat poison.
Okay. You could give me both, and I would not be able to tell you the difference.
I suspect you could. But the other thing I wonder is if we were doing the 1930s version of this podcast, I guess on AM radio somewhere, if you know, the National League hit 300 as a whole, and every player, the cleanup hitter to the reserve catcher, hit 300, if we'd have the same reaction to it then.
I don't know. I do know that if we were doing this podcast 3 years ago, we'd be wondering if we were ever going to see hits again.
Well, it wasn't quite 1968 3 years ago. It was just down a little.
It was trending that way. The numbers across baseball were at, we're in a pitching era now. This is the down after the steroid era or whatever. You're looking at 1980s levels? 2015 was the same league-wide OPS as 1986. 2013 was the same OPS league-wide as 1985.
You're just giving me more heroin because, as you know, the best baseball is the baseball when you were 12 years old, and you're now getting into that vicinity for me. And this is probably just that phenomenon. But it was a very balanced game, and you could have both Steve Balboni and Tony Gwynn, and you could have Wade Boggs and Eric Davis. I mean, to me, Eric Davis, other than the fact that he couldn't stay healthy, was like the most perfect, most versatile ball player ever because he could play an incredible center field, hit 30 home runs, steal 50 bases. And I feel like we had so much of that 30-30 stuff. And you had room for the dead ball style Cardinals that Whitey Herzog had. So I feel like it was a more varied, more dynamic game, especially with more running. And the prevalence on long hitting that we have today means less running, both on the bases, defensively. There's a lot of the ball staying at home plate. Again, you're probably regretting bringing it up because this is like the most predictable answer ever. But I feel like I've got to advocate for that style of baseball.
See, I like that style of baseball, and I enjoyed that. And that was, I'm a little bit younger, and I was 5 years old in 1986. But, you know, I remember Eric Davis in that, in 30-30, being a super cool thing. Steve Balboni leading the league with 36 home runs. I'm not really here for that quite as much. I want my season home run leader to be in the mid-40s. And we had two guys hit 50 this year. Yeah, that's a bit much. Generally, I would think two guys in the 50s is an indication that things are a little off-kilter in favor of the offense. But if nobody's hitting 40, I think that it's tilted too much in favor of the pitchers. And this is obviously very, very general. But what I would like to see is the season home run leader around 45 to 47, where you know that he's not going to hit 50, but in that last couple of weeks of the season, he gets past 45.
Again, this is like a formative thing for me, but nobody hit 50 home runs in the major leagues from what, George Foster in 1977 to Cecil Fielder in 1990. And there were barely any 40 home run guys in that time. Jesse Barfield, Kevin Mitchell.
McGuire hit 49 in 87.
Right. It was a much rarer thing. And I can remember these awful Baseball Digest articles, you know, will anyone ever hit 50 home runs again? And now it's less than it was in the Sosa McGuire days where it seemed like it was just easy for people or commonplace. But you don't want the specialness of that to go away.
Yeah, and I think that, like, Sosa McGuire at that time, the problem isn't Sosa and McGuire so much, because what those guys were doing was chasing the record, and, you know, you can look at it as fine. It's an offensive era. There was expansion in 98. Conditions are ripe for that sort of thing to happen. Where it becomes somewhat ludicrous is when Sean Green and Luis Gonzalez are hitting 50. And don't get me wrong, those guys are real good players, but they are not the kind of guys that should be in the 50 home run club. Brady Anderson as well. And that's really where things sort of started to go haywire on the whole thing was Brady Anderson hitting 50. So I see that, and I dig what you're saying, and I would love it if we could also get back to seeing a world where somebody is stealing 75, 80, 90 bases in a year. You know, is anybody ever going to come close to 100 again?
I mean, Billy Hamilton can do it, but he doesn't get on base often enough.
But he doesn't get, he's fast enough, but he's not a good enough baseball player. Right. I would like a mix. You're not going to get me to say that there's too many home runs to the point that it is supremely problematic.
before we wrap up here and I release us both to the roughly 15 hours of baseball we have remaining today. And again, that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's bad if you were planning on reading Proust today, but otherwise it's a good thing. But the day we are talking is the day after Mike Pence jetted into Indianapolis to protest the protests of the national anthem in the NFL and then jetted back out again. And I was curious if you had any opinion about that.
I'm not the least bit surprised that they did it. And at the same time, I recognize the outright hypocrisy of saying the anthem should not be used as a vehicle for protest and then using the anthem as a vehicle for protesting the protests as done by the people in the position of power. I don't think that I can say very much more without resorting to scads of profanity about the subject. What I did notice last night as I was covering Game 3 at Yankee Stadium, and I certainly tweeted this out at the time, was the giant American flag being held horizontally for the national anthem in disobedience of the United States flag code. And when I pointed this out on Twitter, I was then obviously told, why do you have a problem with this? Nobody's complaining about this. Well, I'm making a point. The original point of the protests during the anthem, they are not anthem protests. They are football players and then one baseball player so far protesting against the ability of the police to get away with murder routinely and then systematic racism in general. And I cannot wait until all of this is simply history.
In regards to what you were saying, that this is not a protest of the anthem or our troops or anything like that, but of executions by the police, I wrote a column about this, about the nature of these protests, and I got a note from a reader that fascinated me because he said, if you're sabermetrically oriented, then you'll understand that just as you have to league and park adjust things, and this is kind of a tasteless thing to do, to take the ultimately trivial aspect of baseball stats and apply them to human lives. But he said, then you will realize that if you look at the information, that police kill whites far more disproportionately than they kill African Americans. And I had to stop and stare at that for a long time and wonder what his point was, because it seemed to me that whether it's true or not, then at best it indicates that the police are killing way too many people regardless of skin color. And it in no way changes the fact that these extra legal executions are sometimes taking place on the streets. And I greatly support our police, and I greatly admire the people who go out and support us. But it's worthwhile to ask these questions. I don't understand what the point is. If they're killing lots of people, then that doesn't make it okay that there are subsets within that group that are of different colors.
Yeah, then shouldn't you also be angry about it? Like, if I don't get it, and I don't get so much right now. There's so much I don't get that I feel like maybe I would get it if I just said, oh, there's a lot of people that are racist who don't realize that they're racist or who are covering up the fact that they're racist. I feel like that may be too easy of a blanket. Maybe people are just easily led astray from truth and reason. I don't know. So far as I am concerned, there's not any explanation for being against the players protesting that makes me okay with it. So I'm not okay with it. I understand that that's sort of the way that it is, and that even contemporaneously, Martin Luther King was unpopular and his protests were unpopular, and that the Freedom Riders were not seen as being helpful to their cause. And you know, you see those retro polls that get posted about that sort of thing. There's an objective right side to be on here, and there are so many people who are objectively on the wrong side about it, and it's tough. It's tough to deal with that because it also makes you question, like, you come into contact with people who you think are otherwise reasonable and otherwise decent people, but some of these issues that we're dealing with are just straight up deal breakers. It's a terrible thing that I struggle to deal with, but that is the way that I feel, that, like, there are basic issues of human decency at stake, and if you're on the wrong side of that, I don't know how I can interact with you, and I don't I don't know how to deal with that. Certainly first world problems as far as these things go when I'm not leaving my house every day worrying if I'm going to be profiled or whatnot. And my problems with this are certainly secondary, but it's just a hard thing to wrap your head around where we're at right now.
Really is. And let me leave it on this note. The thing that I don't understand about the reaction to the protests is not just the willful misconstruing of what they're about, or as you said, the lack of empathy for the topic in general, the unwillingness to just say, well, what are they on about then? If they don't really have a point, then why do they think they have a point? Just to ask any question that might lead to a further dialogue. Mm-hmm. That's strange. And it occurs to me that since this is happening in a sports environment, that sports fans are, as my former employers at SB Nation like to say, tribal, and that they're the most loyal people. They have chosen to adhere to this entity, whatever the team is. And if the Green Bay Packers are going to go 2-14 or 14-2, they're going to be out there wearing their cheese wedges on their head, and ditto the Jets and Giants and so forth. And any team that you can name is going to have its diehard fans. And if, say, the Mets, instead of letting Terry Collins go, retained him, and they brought in Ruben Amaro Jr. to be their GM, and they announced that they're going to replace Travis d'Arnaud as catcher with Austin Romine, and he's going to hit cleanup, then there would be mass protest by Mets fans. And there's a tradition at the Mets, and I don't know if it's so much a living thing now, this tradition, but there used to be, of having sign days and having people come in with signs that actually questioned the direction of the team, given how bad the team was. Mm-hmm. And that is loyalty. That is the ultimate loyalty to the team, and I'm just using the Mets as an example, but it could be any team, of saying the direction that the team is taking is insane, and I want the team to win. I want the team to be good. I don't want those people as my general manager and cleanup hitter. I want good ones, quality ones. And yet, if you ask the same question of your country, you're disloyal, you're a traitor, you're ungrateful. And I don't understand the double standard. We should want the country to be the best country that it can be, and it should be able to withstand a little gentle questioning about how everyone's priorities are organized or what prejudices are at work in the society.
And we've seen that before, and I think that you and I have talked about it maybe even on this show before, of the idea of protesting war. And that when you protest war, people are like, oh, well, why don't you support the troops? And, well, what better way is there to support troops than by believing that they shouldn't be sent to war? I don't know.
Or certainly not for frivolous reasons, or when you're unprepared to send them, or any of another dozen different things. Sure.
This mentality of conformity takes over, and it's, you know, the ultimate appeals to authority. And I think that it's healthy to wonder about the legitimacy of that authority as to fulfilling what you believe are the goals of your sports team or your society in general. Asking questions is something that should be looked upon as a good thing. Some of what we've seen is the development of, and this goes back longer than before this administration, of taking pride in ignorance. If you're looking at where you can point to a downfall of American society, the cultural pushback against intelligence is highly problematic. So let's keep talking about sports.
And as we speak, Chris Sale is in the game for the Red Sox. He's pitched two perfect innings so far, and it's 2-1 Astros as we speak, bottom of the fifth. So we'll see where all this goes. And next time you and I talk, maybe we'll be in the midst of the World Series or some such.
And I will just take the moment to question this as we sign off. The Astros just brought in Justin Verlander in a game that the Astros are leading at Fenway Park. Not a clean inning. There's a runner on base. And I'm kind of wondering if A.J. Hinch has overplayed his hand here.
A.J. Hinch has gone Coffee Joe. This is exactly what I was talking about before. You got my all-time favorite quote, supposedly Pancho Villa's last words, and this is not true because he was machine gunned and died fairly instantly, but supposedly he said, "Don't let it end like this. Tell them I said something." And I think all managers go with that mood when they're in the playoff games. Don't let it end like this. I have to do something. And so, sure, Justin Verlander, sure, Chris Sale, whatever.
And you know what? If this works out, the next time we talk, A.J. Hinch is a genius.
Exactly. He'll be up for the Nobel Baseball Prize. Thank you for stopping by, Jesse. It's greatly appreciated, as always.
Thanks for having me, Steve. It's always a pleasure.
By Athena's incontinent owl, we have reached the end of another program. You can follow Jesse Spector on Twitter at Jesse Spector, and you can follow me at Go Stephen Goldman. Why Go Stephen Goldman? Because Go West Young Man Stephen Goldman seemed like a bad idea given how that worked out for the Donner Party. You can also write us, care of Infinite Inning, at gmail.com, and please rate us at the podcatcher of your choice. I greatly appreciate all of those that carry the show and help bring you here to spend time with me. We have a sponsor now, but nonetheless, just like Sesame Street, this episode is brought to you by the number 19. Dusty Baker called in to say that our producer wouldn't be making it today. He was ill from a moldy air conditioner or something like that, and I asked, well, if you knew that, why didn't you just move him? Anyway, he showed up in the end, but he didn't really get anything done, and I'm really sorry about that. Our theme song is called The Infinite Man, and it was co-authored by myself and Dr. Rick Mooring, who, when we meet at Dunkin' Donuts for what they scrape off the bottom of the pot in a centrally manufactured dessert, always makes me feel a bit self-conscious about the sheer amount of artificial sweetener I put in my coffee. I don't think it's anything personal. Well, if the pizza delivery guy doesn't turn out to be a secret psychopath and bring me a deep dish meatball and razor blade, I'll be back next week with more tales and discussion from inside the Infinite Inning.